Our guest speaker this morning is Reverend Darrell Gowan, who is educated at the Franciscan School of Theology. Darrell joined the Disciples of Christ Christian Church and was ordained in 1995. He is just beginning the next chapter of his journey as he prepares to conclude his pastoral ministry with his disciples so he can focus on writing science fiction as well as guiding individuals and groups into conscious contact with divine and mindful connection. Today, Darrell will speak about the great I am, the context of existence, grounding the question appropriately, and the purpose of our existence. Please join me in welcoming the Reverend Darrell Gowan.
This is great. I've had so much fun in the last month preparing this sermon, and then it dawned on me as I was going over the material yesterday that I had prepared about a 3-hour message. And then no pressure whatsoever, Marlise comes up to me and says, "Well, you know, John always gets it done in 12 to 18 minutes. So I'm going to trust the divine to lead me into awareness as to that part of the message that I'm meant to impart today. And then maybe during the Q&A, we'll touch on some of the other aspects of this question of who are we and what purpose does our life hold? The question of purpose is one that human beings have struggled with from the very beginning. And as early as we began to record our thoughts and share them with others, we hear echoes of this great question. Who are we? Where did we come from? Where are we going? What is this life all about? And the way that question has been addressed through human history gives us some clues as to how we might engage the question today. Early Eastern thought framed the question in terms of living in harmony with Lao Tzu and Taoism. And Lao Tzu counseled people to intuitively experience the laws of nature and lead a simple and desire-free life in order to follow the Tao and return to one's natural wellspring. So Lao Tzu has this deep sense of connection to all that is and intuitively recognizes that life is about regaining conscious awareness of that connection. Does that sound familiar to any of you? It comes back around, doesn't it? And we'll get to how it came back around here in the United States in philosophical reasoning that we are much more familiar with. Eastern thought also talked about living in balance. Shakyamuni Buddha taught the middle way. The middle way is neither about denying oneself or indulging oneself. It's about finding the path in between, where we embrace the reality of our true nature and relieve the suffering of all sentient beings by living and teaching the middle way. Life in balance. And all Eastern thought challenges us to live life toward liberation. Hinduism teaches the meaning of life as being tied up in the concepts of karma, causal action, samsara, the cycle of birth and rebirth, and moksha, liberation. Existence is primarily about continuing on the progression to be free from the cycle of birth and rebirth, and from karma. It's about coming to know ourselves. Judaism in the West challenged humanity to gain contact or to maintain contact with the divine. Reform Judaism today makes clear that connection with the divine is not meant to be one that we melt into, but one that guides us into expression of our humanness. Judaism doesn't see divinity and humanness as coming together in some kind of a conjunction, but rather a connection that informs who we are as we remain always human, and as the divine remains always divine. Islam practices and challenges all of its practitioners around the primary concept of obedience. Obedience to right relationship with Allah, with God, with the divine in our presence. The path of Islam is about total surrender, submission, obedience, purity of heart, and peace as we move into right relationship with the divine. Christianity is an interesting crossroads. The traditional or orthodox Christian view centers around the idea that humankind became estranged from God through what is most often referred to as sin, and is reconciled to God through the forgiveness of sin. And orthodoxy suggests that that forgiveness is gained through Jesus' death on a cross as an atoning sacrifice. Progressive Christians have largely stepped back from that orthodox view and reject the view that Jesus came in order to die, and instead see Jesus as revealing the purpose of life as elevating our compassionate response to human suffering. Progressive Christians focus on Jesus' commands for disciples to love one another as an expression of God's love for all of humanity. Christianity finds itself split from, on the one side, a more orthodox traditional view, and on the other side, a more progressive universalistic view. In the midst of all of this, we have so many other thought systems that have emerged over time. Perhaps one of the most fascinating, and one that has affected all the others in the West, is transcendentalism. In transcendentalism, we come back around once again to the teachings of Lao Tzu. And we see in the writings of Ralph Waldo Emerson, an echo of Lao Tzu: the simple perception of natural form is a delight. To the body and mind which have been cramped by noxious work or company — that never happens. You're never in the company, in noxious company, are you? Nature is medicinal and restores their tone. The tradesman, the attorney, comes out of the din and craft of the street and sees the sky and the woods and is a man again, or woman again. In their eternal calm, they find themselves. Emerson's views became overlaid on most religious practices in the West. And today, Christians, Jews, and many other Westerners find themselves speaking in transcendental language without even necessarily recognizing it. The challenge for all of us when we talk about purpose, when we talk about locating ourselves, why we're here, is first of all to understand a little bit about the journey, how we got to this point. And then secondly, to look for some commonality in all the different approaches we have taken. Since we've been wrestling with this question for so long as human beings, and we've come up with different but related answers, the challenge to us is to say, where are the common threads in all these different faiths and all these different practices as human beings try to maintain a conscious, intuitive connection to what we might call God, what others of us might call the universe, what still others of us might just simply think of as nature, of all that is? What does it mean to understand ourselves in context of all that is. And I really thought when I set out to take a look at this that I would end up, you know, we always have our biases. You start out on the journey and you're pretty sure you know where it's going to end. I was pretty sure it was going to end with the universalistic notion that life is about love. It's about loving one another. It's about loving God and allowing God, or whatever we might think of as the divine principle in our lives, love us. And while that is very common, it's not universalistic. There are philosophies and religions that do not see life's purpose primarily centered around love. And we all express that in different ways. Plato expressed it in terms of good, that the highest virtue was good, and that life is about the intellectual understanding and pursuit of the good. Aristotle came along and said, well, not really. It's kind of about the good, but it's really about practicing virtue so we can experience the good. And we had philosophers build on that in the West, and the Eastern philosophers and religious are all practicing, trying to figure out how do we reconnect to the fundamental, the truest part of who we are. And both Jewish and Christian mysticism were wrestling with this idea of trying to get back to the true self. Isn't it interesting that most religious and philosophically minded people see it as a journey back, or a journey around to where we started, coming back to an awareness that most of us sense has been there all along, but somehow we lost touch with it. Whether we're expressing this as a search for truth, as an expression of the good, as a way of living with balance or harmony or freedom, the universal aspect of this search can best be defined, in my very humble opinion, as authenticity. Sometimes that's expressed as love of self, love of others, love of the divine. But it's also more expansive than that. It's about living in to who we are. It's about always holding before me the question, who am I? And no matter what answer comes out, I ask it again. Who am I? I'm a man. Who am I? I'm John and Myrna McGowan's son. Who am I? And just driving deeper and deeper and deeper into that. Even when we think we come to the primordial answer, to ask again. As a Christian, I might come down to the final answer being, I am beloved of God. And then the challenge is to have the courage to ask again. To never be satisfied with an answer. To live instead into the question. And as I wrestle with this small I am, then I can't help but wrestle with the larger question of what is the great I am? What am I a part of? With my limited understanding of who I am, how do I speak to all that is? We use words, but we know that the words are very poor markers for this great mystery, even if we use the word great mystery. Universe, all that is, God. Or we use some of the ancient words, Elohim, Yahweh, Allah. It doesn't matter what words we know that no matter the moment we've uttered the word, it's not big enough. No matter how big a box we build for the divine or for all that is, it's still too small. Even as Unitarian Universalists who probably have the biggest boxes, you can feel really good about that. Your box is way bigger than anybody else's. It's still too small. The great mystery is still can't be contained in any human understanding. And the challenge for us is to live into the discomfort of that I don't have an answer. But I do have a question, and that's enough. To live into the question of who I am and to see it grounded in the question of all that is. How do I understand that? How do I come into connection with that? How do I maintain a conscious connection that draws me out of my embodied awareness into the larger awareness that vibrates through the universe? And one way we do that is by allowing the ancient words that we use to describe and some of the more modern words we use to describe the all that is, and in the midst of that, name ourselves and know that one is a reflection of the other. That as I look at each of you, I see all that is expressed uniquely in the person that you are. That I come a little closer to understanding, embracing, and being in deep relationship with the divine as I truly see you. That's one of the greatest things about the movie Avatar. Have you all seen the movie Avatar? If you haven't seen it, see it. I know you're thinking, it's science fiction. It's violent because there are some violent scenes in there. It's worth it just for a couple of scenes in the movie. One of the most beautiful is when a human being whose consciousness is being placed technologically in the body of an alien. And so they refer to this alien body as his avatar. And this human being is, when he's occupying his own body, he's paralyzed from the waist down. And he gets around in a wheelchair. But one of the joys he has of having his consciousness brought into an alien body is that for the time that his consciousness resides there, he's able-bodied again. And he falls in love with an alien female. And the two of them transform their world together. But in one poignant scene in the movie, she manages to rescue him from the very edge of death. And she is holding what is now this very, very small, crippled human body. And she's looking into his face that doesn't look familiar to her at all. And as she looks into his face, tears well up in her eyes and she says, "I see you." And he reaches out and takes her face, which is huge and blue and way different than any human face he's ever seen. And his eyes too are filling with tears as he says, "I see you." This is the challenge of locating our I am in the great I am, is to look on every person, on every living creature, on every scene in the wild or in the urban environment where we live, and see the great I am. Because there is nothing where we are not located in that context. So I invite you to engage with me in an experience of this reality. I have here a few names for the great mystery gleaned from different cultures. I will name them. I will utter these names out loud. When one of them resonates for you, when you hear in that name a resonance with who you are, I invite you to name out loud yourself. To just say your name out loud and stand. And in the midst of the interspersing the names that we have gathered over time for the divine, we will hear all of our names. And we will locate our small I ams in the great I am. So I invite you now just to listen for the resonance of your own name. The one who has always loved you. Spirit. Breath. Most High. Merciful Giver. The Formless One. The One beyond all understanding. The Timeless One. Wonderful Teacher. The All-Glorious, the Universe, all that is, the All-Powerful, the Almighty, Allah, Parvardigar, Hu, Om, Alpha, Omega, Source of Life, Ground of Being, Life, Light, Love, the Lord of Hosts, Adonai, Yahweh, Elohim. And now, if you're still seated, I invite you to name that word or words for the divine mystery, and then name yourself and stand with us.
That beyond all understanding.
That beyond all understanding. What are some of the other names for the divine that resonates for you?
Humanity.
Humanity. Nature. Thank you. Harmony.
Balance.
Balance.
Mind.
Spirit. So many words. All boxes that are just a little too small, and yet all together provide the context for every last one of us. Thank you for honoring me with the opportunity to share this morning with you. You can be seated. Okay, so I can't have John come back and have you tell him that I spoke to you without telling you a joke. So there was a young man who was seeking the meaning of life, and he heard that there was a guru on the top of a mountain in Nepal who knew the meaning of life. So he got on a bus and took a bus to the airport, and at the airport he got on a plane and flew to Nepal. And in Nepal he got in a jeep and went to the foothills of the mountains, and there he got onto a donkey and rode the donkey as far as the donkey could get him. And then he crawled on his hands and knees to the top of the mountain and saw the master. And he said, "Master, I've heard you know the meaning of life. Please share it with me." The master looked at him and said, "The meaning of life is mushrooms. The young man paused, kind of looked around, scaled back down as far as he could to get to his donkey, got on the donkey and rode down to the Jeep, got in the Jeep and went back to the airport, got on an airplane and flew back here, got in out of the airplane and onto a bus and went home and met with his family and said, "I have the meaning of life." They said, "Really? What's the meaning of life?" He said, "Mushrooms." They said, "You are stupid. The meaning of life is not mushrooms. I don't know whatever made you think that that was the meaning of life." So the young man got on the bus, went back to the airport, got on the airplane, went back, finally gets back to the master and says, "Master, you're wrong. The meaning of life is not mushrooms." And the master said, "Well, if it's not mushrooms, then it's got to be turnips." It really doesn't matter what we say it is, does it? We can start thinking it's mushrooms or turnips. It's not important the answer we come up with. What's really important is that we never stop asking the question.
For probably half a dozen questions, and please keep your statements or questions short and concise so that we can have as many questions as possible.
One of the things that's always bothered me is that it seems that Orthodox religion has always been opposed to the kind of mystical vision that you've been talking about. Christianity has been the worst, I think, in 2,000 years. There are about four people who were genuine mystics who weren't persecuted as heretics. In Judaism, the mystical tradition in Kabbalah has always been attacked by the rabbis. And in Islam, the mystical tradition of Sufism has often been attacked by the conservative clergy. A number of Sufis were executed as heretics. Why is religion so hostile to religion?
Well, I think we probably all could come up with a lot of different answers for that, but I think primarily, from my limited perspective, it's an issue of control. We as human beings have a really hard time being out of control, and mysticism is always the surrender of control. It is an invitation for humanity to surrender into that which cannot be fully known. That's extraordinarily frightening. It requires that one be very vulnerable, and people in power fear vulnerability. And so I think it only makes sense that as an institution gains power and influence, it's going to become less and less able to tolerate the mystical.
Thank you so much for your observant. It was, at least for me, it gave me a tremendous amount to think about. I like your point that we should live in and live with the process of questioning, continuing to question. That's very important. But I also understand that you, for 20 years, were a minister of the Disciples of Christ Church.
I still am. I pastor First Christian Church.
Well, you know, I'm very familiar with the first cousin of that church, which is the Church of Christ. And both from the very fundamentalist Campbellite tradition.
Mm-hmm.
My question to you, as a minister in the Disciples of Christ, mm-hmm. is, could you have ever given a sermon like this in your church? What kind of reaction did you get from the members of your church? Unless the Disciples of Christ have evolved into a progressive liberal church, which I don't think they have.
First Christian Church of Fullerton is an open, affirming, highly progressive church. Most disciples of Christ on the West Coast and the East Coast are deeply progressive. What you'll find is disciples of Christ in the Midwest are very similar to what you think and what your experience of the Church of Christ. On the West Coast and in the Northeast, disciples of Christ are much closer to the United Church of Christ, which is very progressive. So I gave this same sermon at 8 o'clock this morning in our smaller in the smaller gathering that we have for our early service, and it was very well received. People loved it and felt the big question that I get when I offer messages from this perspective, I have two extremes. The disciples tend to be very diverse, so I have the conservatives who are like, what in the world are you doing mentioning somebody other than Jesus? I get that reaction from a few. But the more common reaction is, why don't we hear more of this? And I think a lot of Christians feel cheated that their consciousness hasn't been expanded more and challenged more by their clergy. But you need to understand, I'm retiring from pastoral ministry in the Christian church because I'm falling off the edge. So, you know, where my path has led me is so far towards the edge of Christian expression that I spend way too much time dealing with conflict over where I'm at than with the challenges of helping a faith community live into who they are. So it's become time for me to serve in more interfaith, inclusive circles.
I wanted to ask you, how is the Old Testament with the vengeful, angry God reconciled with the New Testament? Turn the other cheek, forgive them, but they know not what they do.
Well, my limited understanding, that is an oversimplification. I think the Old Testament God is the God of Psalm 103 that says God throws our shortcomings, our failings, if you prefer traditional language, our sin as far as east is from west. This God of unbelievable forgiveness, the God of Hesed, steadfast love, who continually welcomes God's people no matter how far they get away from the path. So certainly there's a strand in the Old Testament of a judgmental, harsh, exacting God. But that strand exists in the New Testament as well, and it exists in most faith expressions. We human beings have a really hard time accepting forgiveness. One of the hardest things we ever have to do is forgive ourselves. And so it's no surprise that institutional religion has a hard time embodying that. To live into our humanness means to accept our frailty and the certainty that we will make mistakes. We will cause harm. We will cause pain. That's not a possibility. That's a certainty. And yet, to live into that, with the frailty, with the predisposition that when that happens, I will forgive myself. I will honor myself. I will love myself. That is the only hope that I will ever be able to forgive you, to love you, and to honor you in the midst of your mistakes. And it doesn't surprise me that institutionally we've had a hard time embodying that.
Thank you for your dialogue this morning, for our conversation, and a profound, sincere congratulations to you for falling off the edge. Very sincerely. There's not the least bit of hint from myself, anyway, what does Wilbur say? Include but transcend the tradition and the nurturing out of which you have come. And the
the branches of that tree, as you referenced in response to Dennis. We live in extraordinary times where communication and transportation technologies are right here in the palm of our hand. And this process that you personally possibly are going through is also all of ours. And there are so many materials out there right now. Kurt Johnson's Inter-Spirituality,
right.
Evolutionaries, Ken Wilber that I referenced. There is so much material for us to try to absorb in our path to learn how to dialogue with these different traditions and people suffering around the world. And it will possibly continue to be enhanced by the crisis situation of the ecological situation that we face in different ways in different parts of the world right now that are causing these traumas that we must be prepared to engage in and that should inspire us to deepen our capacity to learn these various vocabularies in order to be more truly loving and empathetic and good and virtuous.
I really appreciate your thoughts there. The only caveat I would offer before anybody thinks that I've made some enlightened leap, it's extraordinarily, I'm filled with grief. Oh, I was filled with grief when I left the Roman Catholic Church in the early 90s, having grown up in a church and seeing it reach the cusp of progressive expression through the Second Vatican Council, to then see it turn inward upon itself and go back to being a clergy-centered institution that gave virtually no room for expression of the many people who were the church, and to feel that there was no place for me there anymore, and to know that I could no longer live with the pain of being a transformative presence from within the institution, extraordinarily painful. And coming to the Disciples of Christ and working with them for 20 years, it's a very painful thing to realize that I've outlived my ability to work to be a transformative presence from within the institution. My capacity for that kind of pain is not what it would need to be for me to stay there. And so it is largely out of self-preservation that I'm required to make the move that I'm making. It's not out of some heroic awareness or enlightenment. It's the consciousness that I will lose my conscious connection and lose my ability to live into my own awareness if I remain in that institution. And that's sad to me, because these institutions, these traditional institutions, need transformative voices working from within. And it's sad to me that I'm no longer capable of being one of those voices.
Thank you very much, Reverend Darrell McCowan.